in time to see the walls of the building collapse inward. Then there was the deafening sound of an explosion, and Katie and the kids were knocked over in the scorching blast of air. By the time the three of them caught their breath and turned to look, the store was nothing but a gigantic cone of fire. But they'd made it. She pulled both Josh and Kristen toward her. They were whimpering as she put her arms around them, and she kissed the tops of their heads. "You're okay," she murmured. "You're safe now." It was only when a shadow appeared before her that she realized she was wrong. It was him, looming over them, a gun at his side. Kevin. In the Jeep, Alex kept his foot clamped down on the gas pedal, growing more worried with every passing second. Though the fire was still too far away to pinpoint the location with accuracy, his stomach began to seize up. There weren't too many structures in that direction, mostly a few isolated farmhouses, and of course, the store. He leaned over the steering wheel as if to urge the car forward. Faster! Katie had trouble processing what she was seeing.
"Where is he?"
Kevin rasped out. The words came out slurred, but she recognized the voice, even with his face partly in shadow. The inferno blazed behind him, and his face was covered in soot and blood. There were smears of what she thought was blood on his shirt as well. In his hand, the Glock shone, like it had been dipped in a barrel of oil.
"He's here,"
Joe had said in Katie's dream.
"Who?"
"You know."
Kevin raised the gun, pointing it at her.
"I just want to talk to him, Aaron."
Katie got to her feet. Kristen and Josh clung to her, fear etched on their faces. Kevin's eyes were feral, his movements jerky. He took a step toward them, almost losing his balance. The gun swung back and forth, unsteady. He was ready to kill them all, Katie realized. He'd already tried to kill them with the fire, but drunk, very drunk, worse than she'd ever seen him. He was out of control, beyond reason. She had to get the kids away, had to give them a chance to run.
"Hi, Kevin,"
she purred. She forced herself to smile.
"Why are you holding that gun? Did you come to get me? Are you all right, baby?"
Kevin blinked, the voice soft and sultry, sweet. He liked it when she sounded like that, and he thought it was a dream. But he wasn't dreaming, and Aaron was standing in front of him. She smiled as she took a step forward.
"I love you, Kevin, and I always knew you'd come."
He stared. There were two of her now, and then only one. He had told people she was in New Hampshire taking care of a sick friend, but there weren't any footprints in the snow, and his calls were forwarded, and a little boy had been shot, and there was pizza sauce on his forehead, and now Aaron was here, telling him that she loved him.
Closer, Katie thought.
Almost there. She took another step forward, pushing the kids behind her.
"Can you bring me home?"
Her voice pleaded with him, begged like Aaron used to. But her hair was short and brown, and she was moving closer, and he wondered why she wasn't scared, and he wanted to pull the trigger, but he loved her. If only he could stop the hammering inside his head. Suddenly, Katie lunged forward, pushing the gun away. It fired, the sound like a vicious slap, but she kept moving forward, clinging to his wrist, not letting go. Kristen started to scream.
"Run!"
Katie shouted over her shoulder. "Josh, take Kristen and run. He's got a gun. Get as far away as you can and hide." The panic in Katie's voice seemed to galvanize Josh, and he grabbed Kristen's hand and took off running. They headed toward the road, racing for Katie's house, fleeing for their lives.
"Bitch!"
Kevin screamed, trying to free his arm. Katie lowered her mouth and bit down as hard as she could, and Kevin let out a ferocious cry. Trying to pull the arm free, he slammed his other fist into her temple. Instantly, she saw flashes of white light. She bit down again, finding his thumb this time, and he screamed, letting go of the gun. It clattered to the ground, and he punched her again, catching her on the cheekbone, knocking her to the ground. He kicked her in the back, and she arched with pain. But she kept moving, in panic now, fueled by the certainty that he had meant to kill her and the kids. She had to give them time to get away. She rose to all fours and started crawling, moving fast, gaining speed. Finally, she surged to her feet, a sprinter coming out of the blocks. She ran as fast as she could, forcing herself forward, but she felt his body slam into her from behind, and she lay breathless on the ground again. He grabbed her by the hair and hit her again. He seized an arm and twisted it, trying to work it behind her back, but he was off balance, and she was slippery enough to turn onto her back. Reaching up, she clawed at his eyes, catching one in the corner, tearing hard. Fighting for her life, adrenaline flooding her limbs, fighting now for all the time she hadn't, fighting to give the kids time to run away and hide, screaming curses at him, hating him, refusing to let him beat her again. He snatched at her fingers, tottering off balance, and she used the opportunity to wiggle away. She felt him clawing at her legs, but his grip wasn't good enough, and she pulled one leg free. Pulling her knee up toward her chin, she kicked him with all her force, stunning him as she connected with his chin. She did it again, watching this time as he toppled sideways, his arms grabbing at nothing. She scrambled to her feet and started to run again, but Kevin was up just as quickly. A few feet away, she saw the gun, and she lunged for it. Alex was driving recklessly now, praying for the safety of Kristen and Josh and Katie, whispering their names in panic. He passed the gravel road and rounded the bend, his stomach dropping as his premonition proved right. Before him, the entire tableau spread out beyond his windshield, like a portrait of hell. He noticed movement on the side of the road up ahead. Two small figures dressed in white pajamas. Josh and Kristen. He slammed on the brakes. He was out of the car and rushing toward them almost before the Jeep came to a halt. They cried out for him as they ran, and he bent down to scoop them into his arms. "You're okay," he murmured over and over, holding them in the tight circle of his arms. "You're okay, you're okay." Kristen and Josh were both sobbing and hiccuping, and at first he didn't understand what they were saying because they weren't talking about the fire. They were crying about a man with a gun, that Miss Katie was fighting him, and then he suddenly knew, with chilling clarity, what had happened. He pushed them into the Jeep and wheeled it around, racing toward Katie's house as his fingers punched the speed dial on his cell phone. He reached a startled Joyce on the second ring and told her to have her daughter drive her to Katie's house now, that it was an emergency, that she should call the police immediately. Then he hung up. Gravel sprayed as he came to a skidding halt in front of Katie's house. He dropped the kids off and told them to run inside, that he would be back for them as quick as he could. He counted off the seconds as he turned around and gunned the engine for the store, praying that he wasn't too late. Praying that Katie was still alive. Kevin saw the gun in the same instant she did and dove for it, reaching it first. He snatched it up and pointed it at her, enraged. He grabbed her by the hair and put the gun to her head as he began dragging her across the lot. "Leave me? You can't leave me!" Behind the store, beneath a tree, she saw his car with its Massachusetts plates. The heat from the fire scorched her face, singeing the hair on her arms. Kevin was raging at her, his voice slurred and raw. "You're my wife!" In the distance, she could faintly make out sirens, but they seemed so far away. When they reached the car, she tried to fight again, but Kevin slammed her head onto the roof and she almost passed out. He opened the trunk and tried to force her in. Somehow, she turned and managed to drive her knee into his groin. She heard him gasp and felt his grip loosen momentarily. She pushed blindly, tearing out of his grasp and started running for her life. She knew the bullet was coming, that she was about to die. He couldn't understand why she was fighting, could barely breathe through the pain. She'd never fought him before, had never scratched at his eyes or kicked or bitten him. She wasn't acting like his wife, and her hair was brown, but she sounded like Aaron. He started staggering after her, raising the gun, aiming, but there were two Aarons, and both were running. He pulled the trigger. Katie gasped as she heard the shot, waiting for the flash of pain, but it didn't come. She kept running, and suddenly it occurred to her that he'd missed. She veered left and then right, still in the lot, desperate for some kind of shelter, but there was nothing. Kevin staggered after her, his hands slippery with blood, slipping on the trigger. He felt like he was about to vomit again. She was getting farther away, moving from side to side, and he couldn't keep her in sight. She was trying to get away, but she wouldn't because she was his wife. He would bring her home because he loved her, and then he would shoot her dead because he hated her. Katie saw the headlights of a car on the road, moving as fast as a race car. She wanted to get to the road, to flag the car down, but she knew she wouldn't reach the road in time. Surprising her, the car suddenly began to slow, and all at once she recognized the Jeep as it careened into the lot, recognized Alex behind the wheel, roaring past her, toward Kevin. The sirens were getting closer now. People were coming, and she felt a surge of hope. Kevin saw the Jeep coming and raised the gun. He began firing, but the Jeep kept coming toward him. He leapt out of the way as the Jeep roared past, but it clipped his hand, breaking all the bones and knocking the gun somewhere into the darkness. Kevin screamed in agony, instinctively cradling his hand as the Jeep careened forward, past the burning wreckage of the store, skidding onto the gravel, and crashing headlong into the storage shed. There were sirens in the distance. He wanted to chase Aaron, but he would get arrested if he stayed. The fear took over, and Kevin began to limp and jog to his car, knowing that he had to get out of there, and wondering how everything had gone so wrong. Katie watched Kevin tear out of the lot, gravel spinning, onto the main road. Turning around, she saw that Alex's Jeep was half buried in the storage shed, its engine still spewing exhaust, and she raced toward it. The fire cast its flickering light on the rear of the car, and she felt panic rising inside her as she prayed for Alex to show himself. She was closing in on the car when her foot hit something hard, making her stumble. Spotting the gun she'd tripped on, she picked it up and started toward the car again. Ahead, the door of the car pushed open slightly, but it was blocked by debris on either side. She felt a surge of relief that Alex was alive. At the same instant, she remembered that Josh and Kristen were missing. "Alex!" she cried. She reached the back of the Jeep and started to pound on it. "You have to get out! The kids are out there! Need to find them!" The door was still jammed, but he was able to roll down the window. When he leaned out, she saw he was bleeding from his forehead, and his voice was weak. "They're okay. I brought them to your house." Ice flooded her veins. "Oh my God," she croaked out, thinking, "No, no, no." "Hurry up," she pounded the rear of the car. "Get out! Kevin just left." She could hear the raw fear in her own voice. "That's the direction he went." The pain in his hand was beyond anything he'd ever experienced, and he felt dizzy from blood loss. Nothing was making any sense, and his hand was useless now. He heard the sirens coming, but he would wait for Aaron at her house, because he knew she would be home tonight or tomorrow. He parked behind the other deserted cottage. Strangely, he saw Amber standing behind a tree, asking if he wanted to buy her a drink, but then her image vanished. He remembered that he had cleaned the house and mowed the lawn, but he had never learned how to do laundry. And now Aaron was calling herself Katie. There was nothing to drink, and he was getting so tired. Blood stained his pants, and he realized that his fingers and arm were bleeding too, but he couldn't remember how that had happened. He wanted so much to sleep. He needed to rest for a while, because the police would be searching for him, and he needed to be fresh if they got close. The world around him was growing faint and distant, as if viewed through the far end of a telescope. He heard the trees swaying back and forth. but instead of a breeze, all he felt was the hot summer air. He began to shiver, but he was sweating too. So much blood. And it drained out of his hands and arm, wouldn't seem to stop. He needed to rest, couldn't stay awake, and his eyes began to close. Alex slammed the Jeep into reverse and revved the engine, listening to the wheels spinning, but the Jeep was going nowhere. His mind raced frantically with the knowledge that Josh and Kristen were in danger. He lifted his foot off the gas, engaged the four-wheel drive, and tried again. This time, the Jeep began to move, the side mirrors ripping off, debris scraping and bending its body. The Jeep came free with a final lurch. Katie pulled futilely at the passenger door until Alex rotated in his seat and kicked at it, flinging it open. Katie jumped in. Alex turned the Jeep around and accelerated hard, gaining the road as the fire trucks pulled in. Neither said a word as he slammed the pedal to the floor. Alex had never been more frightened in his life. Around the bend, the gravel road. Alex turned sharply, the car skidding out. The rear fishtailed and he accelerated again. Up ahead, he spotted the cottages, lights glowing in the windows of Katie's. No sign of Kevin's car. And he exhaled before he even realized he'd been holding his breath. Kevin heard the sound of an engine coming down the gravel road, and he jerked awake. The police, he thought, and he automatically reached for his gun, using his crippled hand. He screamed in pain and confusion as he realized that the gun wasn't there. It had been on the front seat, but it wasn't there now, and none of this made sense. He got out of the car and looked up the road. The Jeep pulled into view, the one from the store parking lot, the one that had almost killed him. It came to a stop, and Aaron leapt out. At first, he couldn't believe his good fortune, but then he remembered that she lived here, and it was the reason he'd come. His good hand was shaking hard as he opened the trunk and removed the crowbar. He saw Aaron and her lover racing to the porch. He staggered and limped toward the house, unwilling and unable to stop, because Aaron was his wife and he loved her, and the gray-haired man had to die. Alex skidded to a stop in front of the house, and both of them jumped out simultaneously, running for the door, calling the kids' names. Katie still held the gun. They reached the door just as Josh opened it, and as soon as he saw his son, Alex swept him up in his arms. Kristen came out from behind the couch and rushed toward them. Alex opened his arms to her as well, catching her easily as she jumped. Katie stood just inside the doorway, watching with tears of relief in her eyes. Kristen reached out for her too, and Katie moved closer, accepting Kristen's hug with a blind rush of happiness. Lost in the tidal wave of emotion, none of them noticed Kevin appear in the doorway, crowbar raised high. He swung hard, sending Alex crashing to the floor and the kids stumbling and falling backward in horror and shock. Kevin heard the satisfying thud of the crowbar, felt the vibration up his arm. The gray-haired man lay crumpled on the floor, and Aaron screamed. In that instant, Alex and the kids were all that mattered to her, and Katie instinctively rushed toward Kevin, driving him back out the door. There were only two porch steps, but it was enough, and Kevin toppled backward into the dirt. Katie spun around. "Lock the door!" she screamed, and this time it was Kristen who moved first, even as she screamed. The crowbar had fallen to the side, and Kevin struggled to roll over and stand. Katie raised the gun, pointing it as Kevin finally made it to his feet. He swayed, almost losing his balance, his face a skeletal white. He seemed unable to focus, and Katie could feel the tears in her eyes. "I used to love you," she said. "I married you because I loved you." He thought it was Aaron, but her hair was short and dark, and Aaron was a blonde. A foot lurched forward as he almost fell again. Why was she telling him this? "Why did you start to hit me?" she cried.
I never knew why you couldn't stop, even when you promised. Her hand was shaking, and the gun felt so, so heavy. You hit me on our honeymoon because I left my sunglasses by the pool. The voice was Aaron's, and he wondered if he was dreaming.
I love you, he mumbled. I've always loved you. I don't know why you left me.
She could feel the sobs building in her chest, choking her. Her words flooded out in a torrent, unstoppable and nonsensical, years worth of sorrow.
You wouldn't let me drive or have any friends, and you kept the money and made me beg you for it. I want to know why you thought you could do that to me. I was your wife, and I loved you.
Kevin could barely stay upright. Blood dripped from his fingers and arm to the ground, slippery and distracting. He wanted to talk to Aaron, wanted to find her, but this wasn't real. He was sleeping. Aaron was beside him in bed, and they were in Dorchester. Then his thoughts leapfrogged, and he was standing in a dingy apartment, and a woman was crying. There was pizza sauce on his forehead, he muttered, stumbling forward. On the boy who was shot, but the mom fell down the stairs and we arrested the Greek. She couldn't make sense of what he was saying, couldn't understand what he wanted from her. She hated him with a rage that had been building up for years. I cooked for you and cleaned for you, and none of it mattered. All you did was drink and hit me. Kevin was swaying, like he was about to fall. His words were slurred, unintelligible. There were no footprints in the snow, but the flower pots are broken.
You should have let me go. You shouldn't have followed me. You shouldn't have come here. Why couldn't you just let me go? You never loved me.
Kevin lurched toward her, but this time he reached for the gun, trying to knock it away. He was weak now, though, and she managed to hold on. He tried to grab her, but he screamed in agony when his damaged hand connected with her arm. Acting on instinct, he threw his shoulder into her, driving her against the side of the house. He needed to take the gun away from her and press it into her temple. He stared at her with wide, hate-filled eyes, pulling her close, reaching for the gun with his good hand, using his weight against her. He felt the barrel graze his fingertips and instinctively scrambled for the trigger. He tried to push the gun toward her, but it was moving in the wrong direction, pointing down now.
I loved you,
she sobbed, fighting him with every ounce of rage and strength left in her, and he felt something give way, momentary clarity returning.
Then you never should have left me, he whispered, his breath heavy with alcohol.
He pulled the trigger, and the gun sounded with a loud crack, and then he knew it was almost over. She was going to die, because he'd told her that he'd find her and kill her if she ever ran away again. He would kill any man who loved her. But strangely, Aaron didn't fall, didn't even flinch. Instead, she stared at him with fierce green eyes, holding his gaze without blinking. He felt something then, burning in his stomach. Fire. His left leg gave way and he tried to stay upright, but his body was no longer his own. He collapsed on the porch, reaching for his stomach.
Come back with me, he whispered. Please.
Blood pulsed through the wound, passing between his fingers. Above him, Aaron was going in and out of focus. Blonde hair and then brown again. He saw her on their honeymoon, wearing a bikini before she'd forgotten her sunglasses, and she was so beautiful that he couldn't understand why she'd wanted to marry him. Beautiful. She was always so beautiful, he thought, and then he was tired again. His breaths became ragged, and then he started to feel cold, so cold, and he began to shake. He exhaled once more, the sound like air being released from a tire. His chest stopped moving. His eyes were wide open,
uncomprehending. Katie stood over him, shaking as she stared down at him. No, she thought. I'll never go with you. I never wanted to go back. But Kevin didn't know what she was thinking, because Kevin was gone. And she realized then that it was finally, truly over. Chapter 41. The hospital kept Katie under observation for most of the night before finally releasing her. Afterward, Katie remained in the hospital waiting room, unwilling to leave until she knew Alex would be okay. Kevin's blow had nearly cracked Alex's skull, and he was still unconscious. Morning light illuminated the narrow rectangular windows of the waiting room. Nurses and doctors changed shifts, and the room began to fill with people. A child with a fever, a man having trouble breathing. A pregnant woman and her panicked husband pushed through the swinging doors. Every time she heard a doctor's voice, she looked up, hoping she would be allowed to see Alex. Bruises mottled her face and arms, and her knee was swollen to almost twice its usual size. But after the requisite x-rays and exams, the doctor on call had merely given her ice packs for her bruises and Tylenol for the pain. He was the same doctor who was treating Alex, but he couldn't tell her when Alex would wake and said that the CAT scans were inconclusive. Head wounds can be serious, he'd told her. Hopefully, we'll know more in a few hours. She couldn't think, couldn't eat, couldn't sleep, couldn't stop worrying. Joyce had taken the kids home from the hospital, and Katie hoped they hadn't had nightmares. Hoped they wouldn't have nightmares forever. Hoped Alex was going to recover fully, prayed for that. She was afraid to close her eyes because every time she did, Kevin reappeared. She saw the smears of blood on his face and shirt, his wild eyes. Somehow he'd tracked her down. Somehow he'd found her. He'd come to Southport to take her home or kill her, and he'd almost succeeded. In one night, he had destroyed the fragile illusion of security she had managed to construct since she'd arrived in town. The terrifying visions of Kevin kept coming back, recurring endlessly with variations, sometimes changing entirely. There were moments she saw herself bleeding and dying on the porch, staring up at the man she hated. When that happened, she instinctively groped at her stomach, searching for wounds that didn't exist. But then she was back in the hospital, sitting and waiting under fluorescent lights. She worried about Kristen and Josh. They'd be here soon. Joyce would bring them in to see their father. She wondered if they would hate her because of everything that happened, and the thought made tears sting her eyes. She covered her face with her hands, wishing she could burrow into a hole so deep that no one would ever find her, so that Kevin would never find her, she thought, and then remembered again that she'd watched him die on the porch. The words, "He's dead," echoed like a mantra she couldn't escape. Katie? She looked up and saw the doctor who was now treating Alex. "I can bring you back now," he said. "He woke up about 10 minutes ago. He's still in ICU, so you can't stay long. But he wants to see you." "Is he okay?" "Right now, he's about as good as can be expected. He took a nasty blow." Limping slightly, she followed the doctor as they made their way to Alex's room. She took a deep breath and straightened her posture before she entered, telling herself that she wasn't going to cry. The ICU was filled with machines and blinking lights. Alex was in a bed in the corner, a bandage wrapped around his head. He turned toward her, his eyes only half open. A monitor beeped steadily beside him. She moved to his bedside and reached for his hand. "How are the kids?" he whispered. The words came out slowly, labored. "They're fine. They're with Joyce. She took them home." A faint, almost imperceptible smile crossed his lips. You?
I'm okay, she nodded.
Love you, he said.
It was all she could do not to break down again. I love you too, Alex. His eyelids drooped, his gaze unfocused.
What happened?
She gave him an abbreviated account of the past 12 hours, but mid-story, she saw his eyes close. When he woke again later that morning, he'd forgotten parts of what she had recounted, so she told him again, trying to sound calm and matter-of-fact. Joyce brought Josh and Kristen by, and though children weren't ordinarily allowed in the ICU, the doctor let them visit with their dad for a couple of minutes. Kristen had drawn him a picture of a man lying in a hospital bed, complete with a crayon scrawled, "Get well, Daddy." Josh gave him a fishing magazine. As the day wore on, Alex became more coherent. By the afternoon, he was no longer nodding in and out, and although he complained of a monstrous headache, his memory had more or less returned. His voice was stronger, and when he told the nurse he was hungry, Katie gave a smile of relief, finally sure that he was going to be okay. Alex was released the next day, and the sheriff visited them at Joyce's to get their formal statements. He told them that the alcohol content in Kevin's blood was so high that he'd effectively poisoned himself. Combined with the blood loss he'd suffered, it was a wonder he had been conscious, much less coherent to any degree. Katie said nothing, but all she could think was that they didn't know Kevin or understand the demons that drove him. After the sheriff left, Katie went outside and stood in the sunlight, trying to make sense of her feelings. Though she'd told the sheriff about the events of that night, she hadn't told him everything. Nor had she told Alex everything. How could she, when it barely made sense to her? She didn't tell them that in the moments after Kevin had died and she'd rushed to Alex's side, she'd wept for them both. It seemed impossible that even as she relived the terror of those last hours with Kevin, she also remembered their rare happy moments together. How they'd laughed at private jokes or lounged peacefully on the couch together. She didn't know how to reconcile these conflicting pieces of her past and the horror of what she'd just lived through. But there was something more, too. Something else she didn't understand. She'd stayed at Joyce's because she was afraid to go back home. Later that day, Alex and Katie stood in the parking lot, staring at the charred remains of what had once been the store. Here and there, she could see items she recognized. The couch, half burned, tilted on the rubble. A shelf that once housed groceries. A bathtub, scorched black. A couple of firemen were rooting through the remains. Alex had asked them to look for the safe he'd kept in his closet. He'd removed the bandage, and Katie could see the spot where they'd shaved his head to apply stitches, the area black and blue and swollen. I'm sorry, Katie murmured. For everything. Alex shook his head.
It's not your fault. You didn't do it.
But Kevin came for me.
I know, he said.
He was quiet for a moment.
Kristen and Josh told me how you helped them get out of the house. Josh said that after you grabbed Kevin, you told them to run. He said you distracted him. I just wanted to say thank you.
Katie closed her eyes. You can't thank me for that. If anything had happened to them, I don't know that I could have lived with myself. He nodded, but couldn't seem to look at her. Katie kicked at a small pile of ash that had blown into the parking lot. What are you going to do about the store?
Rebuild, I guess.
Where will you live?
I don't know yet. We'll stay at Joyce's for a bit, but I'll try to find someplace quiet, someplace with a view. Since I can't work, I might as well try to enjoy the free time.
She felt sick to her stomach. I can't even imagine how you feel right now.
Numb, sad for the kids, shocked.
And angry?
No, he said. I'm not angry.
But you lost everything.
Not everything, he said. Not the important things. My kids are safe. You're safe. That's all I really care about. This, he said, motioning, is just stuff. Most of it can be replaced. It just takes time.
When he finished, he squinted at something in the rubble.
Hold on for a second, he said.
He walked toward a pile of charred debris and pulled out a fishing pole that had been wedged between blackened planks of wood. It was grimy, but otherwise looked undamaged. For the first time since they'd arrived, he smiled.
Josh will be happy about this, he said. I just wish I could find one of Kristen's dolls.
Katie crossed her arms over her stomach, feeling tears in her eyes. I'll buy her a new one.
You don't have to. I'm insured.
But I want to. None of this would have happened if it hadn't been for me. He looked at her.
I knew what I was getting into when I first asked you out.
But you couldn't have expected this.
No, he admitted. Not this. But it's going to be okay.
How can you say that?
Because it's true. We survived. And that's all that matters.
He reached for her hand, and she felt his fingers intertwine with hers.
I haven't had a chance to say that I'm sorry.
Why would you be sorry?
For your loss.
She knew he was talking about Kevin, and she wasn't sure what to say. He seemed to understand that she'd both loved and hated her husband. I never wanted him to die, she began. I just wanted to be left alone.
I know.
She turned tentatively toward him. Are we going to be okay? I mean, after all this?
I suppose that depends on you.
Me?
My feelings haven't changed. I still love you. But you need to figure out whether your feelings have changed.
They haven't.
Then we'll find a way to work through all this together. Because I know I want to spend the rest of my life with you.
Before she could respond, one of the firemen called out to them as they turned in his direction. He was working to free something, and when he stood, he was holding a small safe. Do you think it was damaged? Katie said.
It shouldn't be, Alex answered. It's fireproof. That's why I bought it.
What's in it?
Mainly records, but I'm going to need them. Some photo discs and negatives. Things I wanted to protect.
I'm glad they found it.
So am I, he said.
He paused.
Because there's something in there for you, too.
Chapter 42. After dropping Alex off at Joyce's, Katie finally drove back home, not wanting to return, but knowing she couldn't put off the inevitable forever. Even if she didn't intend to stay there, she needed to pack up some of her belongings. Dust rose from the gravel, and she bounced through the potholes before pulling to a stop out front. She sat in the Jeep, dented and scraped, but still running fine, and stared at the door, remembering how Kevin had bled to death on her porch, his gaze fixed on her face. She didn't want to see the bloodstains. She was afraid that opening the door would remind her of the way Alex had looked after Kevin struck him. She could practically hear the sounds of Kristen and Josh crying hysterically as they clung to their father. She wasn't prepared to relive all of that. Instead, she started toward Joe's. In her hand was the letter that Alex had given her. When she'd asked him why he'd written to her, he'd shaken his head.
It's not from me, he'd said.
She'd stared at him, confused.
You'll understand, once you read it, he'd told her.
As she approached Joe's, she felt the trace of a memory stir to life. Something that happened on the night of the fire. Something she'd seen but couldn't quite place. Just as she felt her mind closing in on it, the memory slipped away. She slowed as she drew nearer to Joe's house,
a frown of confusion creasing her face. There were cobwebs on the window, and a shutter had fallen to the ground where it lay shattered in the grass. The porch railing was broken, and she could see weeds sprouting between the planks. Her eyes took in everything, but she was unable to process the scene before her. A rusted doorknob, half dangling from the door. Grime on the windows as if they hadn't been cleaned in years. No curtains. No entry mat. No wind chime. She hesitated, trying to make sense of what she was seeing. She felt odd and curiously weightless, as if she were in a waking dream. The closer she got, the more the house seemed to decay before her. She blinked and noticed that the door was cracked down the middle with a 2x4 hammered across it, bracing it to the crumbling casing. She blinked again and saw that part of the wall, up in the corner, had rotted away, leaving a jagged hole. She blinked a third time and realized that the lower half of the window was cracked and broken. Pieces of glass littered the porch. Katie climbed onto the porch, unable to stop herself. Leaning in, she peered through the windows into the darkened cottage. Dust and dirt, broken furniture, piles of garbage. Nothing painted, nothing cleaned. All at once, Katie stepped back on the porch, almost stumbling off the broken step. No, it wasn't possible. It just wasn't. What had happened to Joe? And what about all the improvements she'd made on the small cottage? Katie had seen Joe hang the wind chime. Joe had been over to her house, complaining about having to paint and clean. They'd had coffee and wine and cheese, and Joe had teased Katie about the bicycle. Joe had met her after work, and they'd gone to a bar. The waitress had seen them both. Katie had ordered both of them wine. But Joe's glass had been untouched, she recalled. Katie massaged her temples, her mind racing, searching for answers. She remembered that Joe had been sitting on the steps when Alex dropped her off. Even Alex had seen her. Or had he? Katie backed away from the decaying home. Joe was real. There was no way she'd been a figment of her imagination. She hadn't made her up. But Joe liked everything you did. She drank her coffee the same way. She liked the clothes you bought. Her thoughts about the employees at Ivan's mirrored your own. A dozen random details suddenly began crowding her mind, and voices dueled in her head. She lived here. But why is it such a dump? We looked at the stars together. You looked at the stars alone, which is why you still don't know their names. We drank wine at my house. You drank the bottle by yourself, which was why you were so dizzy. She told me about Alex. She wanted us to be together. She never mentioned his name until you already knew it, and you were interested in him all along. She was the kids' counselor, which was the excuse you used as a reason to never tell Alex about her. But, one by one, the answers came as quickly as she could think of them. The reason she'd never learned Joe's last name or saw her drive a car. The reason Joe never invited her over or accepted her offer to help her paint. How Joe had been able to magically appear at Katie's side in jogging clothes. Katie felt something give way inside her as everything clicked into place. Joe, she suddenly realized, had never been there at all. Chapter 43. Still feeling as if she were in a dream, Katie stumbled back to her house. She took a seat in the rocker and stared at Joe's house, wondering if she'd gone utterly mad. She knew that the creation of imaginary friends was common among children, but she wasn't a child. And yes, she'd been under a great deal of stress when she arrived in Southport. Alone and friendless, on the run and looking over her shoulder, terrified that Kevin was closing in, who wouldn't be anxious? But was that enough to have prompted the creation of an alter ego? Maybe some psychiatrists would say yes, but she wasn't so sure. The problem was that she didn't want to believe it. She couldn't believe it, because it had felt so real. She remembered those conversations, could still see Joe's expressions, still hear the sound of her laughter. Her memories of Joe felt as real as her memories of Alex did. Of course, he probably wasn't real either. Probably made him up too. And Kristen and Josh. She was probably strapped to a bed in an asylum somewhere, lost in an entire world of her own creation. She shook her head, frustrated and confused. And yet, there was something else nagging at her, though. Something she couldn't quite put her finger on. She was forgetting about something. Something important. As much as she tried, she couldn't seem to place it. The events of the past few days had left her feeling drained and jittery. She looked up. Dusk was beginning to spread across the sky, and the temperature was falling. Near the trees, a mist was starting to roll in. Looking away from Joe's house, which was how she'd always refer to it, regardless of the state of mind it implied, Katie reached for the letter and examined it. The outer envelope was blank. There was something frightening about the unopened letter, even though she wasn't sure why. It might have been Alex's expression as he'd handed it over. Somehow she knew it was not only serious, but also important to him, and she wondered why he hadn't told her anything about it. She didn't know, but it would be getting dark soon, and she knew she was running out of time. Turning the envelope over, she lifted the seal. In the waning light, she ran her finger over the yellow legal paper before unfolding the pages. Finally, she began to read. To the woman my husband loves, if it seems odd for you to read these words, please believe me when I tell you that it feels just as odd to write them. Then again, nothing about this letter feels normal. There's so much I want to say, so much I want to tell you. And when I first put pen to paper, everything was clear in my mind. Now, however, I find myself struggling, and I'm not sure where to begin. I can start by saying this. I've come to believe that in everyone's life, there's one undeniable moment of change, a set of circumstances that suddenly alters everything. For me, that moment was meeting Alex. Though I don't know when or where you're reading this, I know it means he loves you. It also means he wants to share his life with you. And if nothing else, we will always have that in common. My name, as you probably know, is Carly. But for most of my life, my friends called me Joe. Katie stopped reading and looked at the letter in her hands, unable to absorb its words. Taking a deep breath, she reread those words. For most of my life, my friends called me Joe. She gripped the pages, feeling the memory she'd been struggling to retrieve come into focus at last. Suddenly, she was back in the master bedroom on the night of the fire. She felt the strain in her arms and back as she heaved the rocking chair through the window, felt the surge of panic as she wrapped Josh and Kristen in the comforter, only to hear the loud splintering sound behind her. With sudden clarity, she remembered whirling around and seeing the portrait hanging on the wall, the portrait of Alex's wife. At the time, she'd been confused, her nerves short-circuiting in the hell of smoke and fear. But she'd seen the face. Yes, she'd even taken a step closer to get a better look. That looks a lot like Joe, she remembered thinking, even if her mind hadn't been able to process it. But now, As she sat on the porch beneath a slowly darkening sky, she knew with certainty that she was wrong. Wrong about everything. She raised her eyes to gaze at Joe's cottage again. It looked like Joe, she suddenly realized, because it was Joe. Unbidden, she felt another memory float free from the first morning that Joe had come over. My friends call me Joe, she had said, by way of introduction. Oh, my God. Katie paled. Joe. She hadn't imagined Joe, she suddenly knew. She hadn't made her up. Joe had been here, and she felt her throat begin to tighten. Not because she didn't believe it, but because she suddenly understood that her friend Joe, her only real friend, her wise advisor, her supporter and confidant, would never come back. They would never have coffee. They would never share another bottle of wine. They would never visit on the porch out front. She'd never hear the sound of Joe's laughter or watch the way she arched her eyebrow. She would never hear Joe complain about having to do manual labor, and she began to cry, mourning the wonderful friend she'd never had the chance to meet in life. She wasn't sure how much time passed before she was able to begin reading again. It was getting dark, and with a sigh, she stood and unlocked the front door. Inside, she took a seat at the kitchen table. Joe, she remembered, had once sat in the opposite chair, and for a reason she couldn't explain, Katie felt herself begin to relax. Okay, she thought to herself. I'm ready to hear what you have to say. But for most of my life, my friends called me Joe. Please feel free to call me either. And just so you know, I already consider you a friend. I hope by the end of this letter, you'll feel the same about me. Dying is a strange business, and I'm not going to bore you with the details. I might have weeks, or I might have months, and though it's a cliche, it's true that so many of the things I once believed to be important no longer are. I don't read the newspaper anymore, or care about the stock market, or worry whether it's going to rain while I'm on vacation. Instead, I find myself reflecting on the essential moments of my life. I think about Alex, and how handsome he looked on the day we were married. I remember my exhausted elation when I first held Josh and Kristen in my arms. They were wonderful babies. And I used to lay them in my lap and stare at them while they slept. I could do that for hours, trying to figure out whether they had my nose or Alex's, his eyes or mine. Sometimes, while they were dreaming, their little fists would curl around my finger. And I can remember thinking that I'd never experienced a purer form of joy. It wasn't until I had children that I really understood what love meant. Don't get me wrong, I love Alex deeply, but it's different from the love I feel for Josh and Kristen. I don't know how to explain it, and I don't know that I need to. All I know is that despite my illness, I nonetheless feel blessed because I've been able to experience both. I've lived a full, happy life and experienced the kind of love that many people will never know. But my prognosis scares me. I try to be brave around Alex, and the kids are still too young to understand what's really happening. But in quiet moments when I'm alone, the tears come readily. And sometimes I wonder if they're ever going to stop. Though I know I shouldn't, I'll find myself dwelling on the fact that I'm never going to walk my children to school, or that I'll never get another chance to witness their excitement on Christmas morning. I'll never help Kristen shop for a prom dress or watch Josh play baseball. There is so much I will never see and do with them. And sometimes I despair that I'll be nothing but a distant memory by the time they get married. How can I tell them that I love them if I'm no longer there? And Alex,
He's my dream and my companion, my lover and my friend. He's a devoted father, but more than that, he's my ideal husband. I can't describe the comfort I feel when he takes me in his arms, or how I look forward to lying down beside him at night. There's an unshakable humanity about him, a faith in the goodness of life, and it breaks my heart to imagine him alone. That's why I've asked him to give you this letter. I thought of it as a way of making him keep his promise that he would find someone special again, someone who loves him and someone he could love. He needs that. I was blessed to be married to him for 5 years, and I've mothered my children for less time than that. Now my life is almost over, and you are going to take my place. You'll become the wife who grows old with Alex, and you'll become the only mother my children will ever know. You can't imagine how terrible it is to lie in bed, staring at my family and knowing these things, and realizing there's nothing I can do to change them. Sometimes I dream that I'll find a way to come back, that I can find a way to ensure they're going to be all right. I like to believe that I'll watch over them from heaven, or that I can visit them in their dreams. I want to pretend that my journey isn't over, and I pray that the boundless love I feel for them will somehow make it possible. This is where you come in. I want you to do something for me. If you love Alex now, then love him forever. Make him laugh again and cherish the time you spend together. Take walks and ride your bikes. Curl up on the couch and watch movies beneath a blanket. Make him breakfast, but don't spoil him. Let him make breakfast for you as well, so he can show you he thinks you're special. Kiss him and make love to him, and consider yourself lucky for having met him, for he's the kind of man who'll prove you right. I also want you to love my children in the same way I do. Help them with their homework, and kiss their scraped elbows and knees when they fall. Run your hand through their hair, and assure them they can do anything they put their mind to. Tuck them in at night and help them say their prayers. Make their lunches. Support them in their friendships. Adore them. Laugh with them. Help them grow into kind, independent adults. What you give them in love, they'll return tenfold in time, if only because Alex is their father. Please, I beg you, do these things for me. After all, they are your family now, not mine. I'm not jealous or angry that I've been replaced by you. As I mentioned already, I consider you a friend. You've made my husband and children happy, and I wish I were around to be able to thank you in person. Instead, all I can do is assure you that you have my everlasting gratitude. If Alex has chosen you, then I want you to believe that I have chosen you as well. Your friend in spirit, Carly Jo. When Katie finished reading the letter, she wiped her tears and ran her finger over the pages before slipping them back into the envelope. She sat quietly, thinking about the words that Joe had written, already knowing she would do exactly as Joe had asked. Not because of the letter, she thought, but because she knew that in some inexplicable way, Joe was the one who gently urged her to give Alex a chance in the first place. She smiled. "Thank you for trusting me," she whispered, and she knew that Joe had been right all along. She'd fallen in love with Alex, and she'd fallen in love with the children, and she already knew that she couldn't imagine a future without them. It was time to go home, she thought. It was time to see her family. Outside, the moon was a brilliant white disk
that guided her as she made her way toward the jeep. But before climbing in, she glanced over her shoulder in the direction of Joe's. The lights were on, and the windows of the cottage were glowing yellow. In the painted kitchen, she saw Joe standing near the window. Though she was too far away to make out much more than that, Katie had the sense she was smiling. Joe raised a hand in a friendly farewell, and Katie was reminded again that love can sometimes achieve the impossible. When Katie blinked, however, the cottage was dark again. No lights were on, and Joe had vanished. But she thought she could hear the words in the letter being carried on the gentle breeze. If Alex has chosen you, then I want you to believe that I have chosen you as well. Katie smiled and turned away, knowing it wasn't an illusion or a figment of her imagination. She knew what she saw. She knew what she believed. Acknowledgements. At the completion of every novel, I always find myself reflecting on those people who've helped me along the way. As always, the list begins with my wife, Kathy, who not only has to put up with the creative moodiness that sometimes plagues me as a writer, but has lived through a very challenging year, one in which she lost both her parents. I love you, and wish there were something I could have done to lessen the loss you feel. My heart is with you. I'd also like to thank my children, Miles, Ryan, Landon, Lexi, and Savannah. Miles is off in college, my youngest are in the third grade, and watching all of them grow is always a source of joy. My agent, Teresa Park, always deserves my thanks for all she does to help me write the best novel I possibly can. I'm lucky to work with you. Ditto for Jamie Robb, my editor. She's taught me much about writing, and I'm thankful for her presence in my life. Denise DeNovi, my Hollywood friend and producer of a number of my films, has been a source of joy and friendship over the years. Thank you for all you've done for me. David Young, the CEO of Hachette Book Group, is both smart and terrific. Thanks for tolerating the fact that I'm endlessly late on delivering my manuscripts. Howie Sanders and Kaya Kayatian, my film agents, have worked with me for years, and I owe much of my success to their hard work. Jennifer Romanello, my publicist at Grand Central Publishing, has worked with me on every novel I've written, and I consider myself lucky for all she does. Edna Farley, my other publicist, is professional and diligent, and is fabulous at helping to make my tours run smoothly. Thank you. Scott Schwimmer, my entertainment attorney, is not only a friend, but also exceptional at negotiating the finer points of my contracts. I'm honored to work with you. Abby Coons and Emily Sweet, a couple of cohorts at Park Literary Group, deserve my thanks for all they do with my foreign publishers, my website, and any contracts that come my way. You're the best. Marty Bowen and Wick Godfrey, who did a terrific job as the producers of Dear John, deserve my thanks for the work they did. I appreciate the care they showed the project. Likewise, Adam Shankman and Jennifer Gibgo, the producers of The Last Song, were terrific to work with. Thanks for all you did. Courtney Valenti, Ryan Cavanaugh, Tucker Tooley, Mark Johnson, Lynn Harris, and Lorenzo Di Bonaventura all showed great passion for the films adapted from my novels, and I want to thank you all for everything you've done. Thanks also to Sharon Krasny, Flag, and the team of copy editors and proofreaders who had to work late evenings to get this novel ready to print. Jeff Van Wee, my screenwriting partner on The Last Song, deserves my thanks for his passion and effort in crafting screenplays, along with his friendship.
This has been an Hachette audio production of Safe Haven. Written by Nicholas Sparks. Read by Rebecca Lohman. Produced by John Clem. Directed by Bob Dion. Audio edited by Dion Audio Services. Mixed and mastered by John Clem. Safe Haven is also available in print from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2010 by Nicholas Sparks. Audio production copyright and published 2010 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.